is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Epicurious, one of the biggest online food magazines, announced last week that it will no longer publish new beef recipes on their website. In a statement, they said, quote, "Our shift is solely about sustainability, about not giving airtime to one of the world's worst climate offenders. We think of this decision as not anti-beef, but rather pro-planet." Some are praising the move. Others are having a cow. It's safe to say that hamburgers aren't going anywhere, but how is climate change complicating America's love affair with beef? Joining us to talk about it is Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer. Her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. Alicia, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is James Homan. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, and the headline of his most recent op-ed is "My Beef with Epicurious." James, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And also with us, Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. She's worked as a farmer, a butcher, and a chef. Meredith, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So all of you come at beef consumption from very different angles, and I want to hear your reaction to this move by Epicurious. Alicia, let's start with you.
I think it's an important move because we haven't seen this kind of stance taken by a food website or food section. And, you know, the impact of beef can't be denied. The impact of specifically industrial factory farm beef that's heavily subsidized can't be denied. And so I think that Epicurious sort of just saying, you know, we're not going to support this anymore. We're not going to give our attention to this, because attention is a really significant thing when you're talking about recipes and how you influence people in the supermarket. And so I think for me, it's a good thing.
James, what about for you?
Well, it has me stewing. I have used Epicurious constantly during the pandemic to start cooking and to grill, and have tried making every single meat for sale at my butcher shop around the corner. And it has been a really useful website. It's been a nice escape from a lot of the terrible things that have happened over the last year. And the move by Epicurious, you know, is owned by Condé Nast, the most powerful magazine publisher really in the world. It just smacks of performative environmentalism, that individual actions really aren't going to make the difference. We need collective action to tackle climate change. We need the government to take steps. We need big corporations to take steps. It feels kind of insulting almost to have a kind of corporate paternalism to not even give readers these beef recipes, or to give them warnings on how to be more sustainable or how to approach cooking or how to use smaller portions, but instead to just say, we're not going to give you any beef recipes at all, frankly, felt condescending and insulting.
Meredith?
I guess I'm the middle voice here, because I tend to agree with both of you. I think it's sort of not surprising for Epicurious to make a move like this, and it is a little stunt-ish. In my opinion, I mean, it's a huge company, as James has noted, and I think that, you know, they're not eliminating beef in all of their brands, so there is a performative aspect to that and a sense of safety for them. But I do think that, you know, we're all here talking about this now in an intelligent way, and that's important because we do need to change the way we have a relationship with meat in America. So I see both sides.
Alicia, what are the environmental costs of eating and producing beef?
You know, livestock accounts for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. We're using a lot of land to feed that livestock. You know, this, we could change the way we use land in order to feed people a more diverse diet, but we're using it to provide, you know, only 18% of calories that we're getting from meat. And so, you know, people are eating more beef than they were 50 years ago. Production has ramped up, and so It's a huge impact that beef has specifically. But again, we also need to talk about different aspects. There needs to be more nuance in the conversation. You know, it's not just beef that has a big impact. And we could talk about, you know, the sustainable ways of producing beef that I think Meredith knows a lot about. But we're not, you know. And so, as she said, I think Epicurious making this move because beef has this big popular impact is good, but it should start a new conversation where we're really talking about the nuances in the food system and why why we are producing meat this way, why we're producing so much meat, why we eat so much meat. And we have to have that conversation too.
And we'll get more into that a little later in the hour, as well as the history of America's relationship with beef. But Meredith, you've worked as a farmer and a butcher and a chef, and you've seen the process through which cows become the beef on our plate. What to you is wrong with the way we produce beef?
Well, the way that livestock rearing and meat production has become super consolidated and, you know, corporate and sort of irreverent of lives, both animal lives and human lives, is hugely problematic. It's pollutive. It's unjust. I could go on for the entire program. But I think, you know, that's a problem that we have with the entire food system. So Alicia's spot on when she notes that we have ways of, you know, reforming agriculture and reforming the system as a whole that really take into account the concerns that we have about beef and animal agriculture, as well as, you know, some of our vegetable and grain products, without just, you know, wholesale discounting the use of herbivores like cows in our farm ecosystems.
We got this question from Kyle on Twitter, who asks, is Epicurious taking down the existing beef recipes or just not making new content? James?
They're not. They're keeping the old recipes up, which is good. But it sort of gets to the point of them being this incredibly powerful player in this space. And they're publicly urging all other food media to follow course and to take away beef recipes, to basically cancel cows. And we're seeing it backfire. It plays right into the hands of right-wing politicians who were saying that, you know, Joe Biden wants to take away your hamburger, and which is obviously not true. But it is this kind of red meat to the culture war loving base of the Trump controlled Republican Party. And this has become a helpful talking point for them.
Well, we got this message from Mari on Facebook, who says, as someone who grew up on a working farm, beef was one of the sources of protein in our diet. It was part of my upbringing and my life for a long time. As a protein source, lean beef delivers it nutritionally. It has been part of the tastiest meals and celebrations for my entire 67 years. Now, James, in your op-ed, you talk about beef as something that's brought you closer to the people around you. Why is beef so important to you?
Yeah, so I really never cooked much before the pandemic. And I, when everything closed, my colleagues started making sourdough bread. I decided I could try making some different steaks, and I loved it. And got a little charcoal grill, and my girlfriend and I bonded over it. My mom was excited that I took up cooking and started sending, you know, different knives and spices and everything. And it really was just the kind of the most wonderful distraction during the pandemic. And I agree, you know, with that listener, the nutrients are incredible. It's fun to experiment with different recipes and different cuts. And it brought me quite a lot of joy during the last 13 months.
Now, in that same op-ed, James, you write, beef tastes more than 20 times better than beans. But Alicia, you've been very vocal about your frustration with the idea that vegans don't care about how food tastes. Where do you think that myth came from?
The myth came from, you know, the idea that meat has to be the central part of our plates. It's a very American idea. It's a very, it's connected to, you know, patriarchy, masculinity. You know, there's a reason that when I was growing up, there were commercials on TV with a cowboy saying, beef, it's what's for dinner. You know, and I am not advocating that anyone take away steak from people and that they have to give up that joy. What I'm saying is that there is joy to be found in beans. There is joy to be found in other proteins that don't have this detrimental effect on the environment, because it's beautiful that some people are going to their neighborhood butcher and buying, you know, well-raised steak from a cow that had a good life. That's not what most people are eating. And so the significant thing to me is talking about how to diversify the diets of Americans, because we are eating too much meat. You know, the numbers are, you know, 222 pounds per year per person on average. And so for me, it's about diversifying. You know, maybe you eat your steak, but you also eat beans and you also eat lentils.
Meredith, I want to circle back to this question of efficiency. What does it mean to say raising cows is less efficient than growing beans?
Well, that's also a nuanced sort of question with a nuanced answer. It depends on how you're raising the cows and how you're raising the beans, you know. But I think according to this, like, agricultural paradigm that's been developed in a colonial, you know, kind of capitalistic way, then you can produce more beans and produce more calories per, you know, like gallon of water per acre of land than you can, you know, pound of beef. But that's sort of just like the research is mostly about beef that's raised in the industrial paradigm. And so what the conversation, I think what people are hungry for is a conversation about other ways to diversify the palate and other ways to diversify our agriculture. And so, you know, big bombastic moves like eliminating beef from Epicurious don't necessarily get us there. And I think that's what we're really, really aiming for.
We're talking to Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Also with us is Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer. Her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And James Holman. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He wrote an op-ed expressing his frustration with Epicurious's decision not to publish new beef recipes. We're also hearing from you. Christopher writes on Facebook, I developed a red meat allergy from a tick bite. I have not been able to eat beef, dairy, or any mammal products for years now. It was a shock at first, but after the adjustment, my life is much better. I eat a lot healthier, my cholesterol is low, and my diet is more variable now. Even if I lost the allergy, I would not go back, and I say this as a lover of beef and milk. After learning about the climate and land use implications, I just could not go back in good conscience. Well, coming up, more Americans are choosing to go meatless, but how many people would it take for that move to make an impact on the environment? I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing our relationship to beef and its environmental costs with Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Also with us is Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer, and her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. Also with us, James Holman. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, and he wrote an op-ed expressing his frustration with Epicurious's decision not to publish new beef recipes. We also want to hear from you. What's your relationship to beef? If it's important to you, tell us why. We'd also love to hear from you if you're vegan. Why have you chosen to give up animal products? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. And if you fall anywhere in between, feel free to share your thoughts as well. Now, we heard from several of you who've given up meat entirely.
Hey, it's Tara from Tucson, Arizona. Been a vegetarian for about 10 years. The reason I became a vegetarian had everything to do with the environment and animal cruelty issues. Once I found out more about how animals in this country are raised for food, I was beyond appalled.
Hey, this is Kat from Virginia. And I've been mostly vegan since about 2006, and we have three kids, and we've been raising them vegetarian. They really, my eight-year-old loves it for climate change. When he hears about climate change, he can feel good about his diet.
Hi, my name is Jamie Overman from Poolsville, Maryland. At age 46, I developed, without any cardiovascular risk factors, a heart attack, and 3 years later, progressive atherosclerotic disease. I am an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and educated in medicine and risk factors, and plant-based diets reverse this. And this has truly been life-changing for me.
Tara, Kat, Jamie, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. Alicia, why did you decide to become vegan?
Well, I'm mostly vegan. I say I'm 90% vegan, 10% vegetarian, because I do eat eggs from the farmer's market, a little goat cheese from the farmer's market. I live here in San Juan in Puerto Rico. We import 85% of the food. And so it's good for me to support those local economies and support local proteins. And so, you know, I went vegan and stopped eating meat initially, you know, out of ethical concerns for animals, you know, who are mostly living awful lives in the industrial animal agriculture system. And, you know, also the reasons of climate change. You know, an Oxford study shows that if people, if everyone went vegetarian, food-related emissions would drop by 60%. If everyone went vegan, emissions would drop about 70%. There's, of course, a lot more nuance there to discuss, but at the same time, it's hard to deny that there are wonderful impacts to eating less meat, especially red meat, especially beef, and there are great also diet-related health impacts to eating less meat, as one of those callers noted.
Well, James, this is one of your biggest critiques about Epicurious' decision to not publish any new beef recipes, because you say it suggests that individual choices we make can combat climate change. Why don't you think that's true?
Yeah, I think that there was something that happened in the 1970s, which was the biggest corporate polluters of carbon and plastic invested many millions of dollars in a big ad campaign that was designed to convince Americans that we could solve our pollution problem with individual action rather than collective action. And small government conservatives have been pushing this. And corporations and government have sort of stepped back from taking a leadership role in addressing the climate crisis. And when you look at something like last week, the Senate voted mostly along party lines to restore some Obama-era methane regulations that Trump had undone, that's going to have a vastly bigger impact on climate change than any kind of individual action, even in some bulk. And part of it is, you know, if you get rid of some of this cattle ranching, a lot of that land is just going to be developed and used for housing or other purposes that also isn't going to be helpful for the environment. And the nutrients that people get from meat are important and helpful. It's not, you know, red meat in excess. Everything is good in moderation, and in excess is bad, but it's full of just vital minerals and other things that humans need and that are hard to find offsets for.
Meredith, you're critical of the way beef and other meat are produced on a mass scale, as you've shared with us. You even used to be a vegetarian, but you returned to meat eating. How do you think about that balance of individual action as opposed to collective action?
Well, I think there's certainly benefits to eaters becoming activists and taking individual actions to try to reverse climate change. There's no doubt that that's a factor. And I think that, you know, there's other reasons for eaters to be activists, like busting up the system or reversing climate change is one, but literally keeping ourselves alive is another unfortunate thing that American eaters face. But I think, you know, James has a point, too, that like there's a problem with the narrative that we have that these issues are the consumer's problem to solve. The problem with the meat industry and the problem with the food industry in general is a design problem that was created by corporations that run on colonial norms. And the way we put the onus on the eater culturally is really fraught. And I think to suggest this problem will be solved by cooks is sort of awful. It ignores food injustice and it's culturally insensitive in a lot of ways. And it plays into the hands of business as usual for the industry and for politics as usual.
Meredith, what went into your decision to return to eating meat?
Well, I did a lot of traveling to observe how folks that were farming in more indigenous ways were incorporating animals into agriculture, and really was able to see the way that animals were giving back to farm ecosystems. And so the part of this conversation that becomes really important is how can beef be raised in a way that builds soil and actually sequesters carbon and, you know, develops, you know, ways of mitigating methane emissions right there in the pasture. And so that's the part of the conversation that I have, you know, started eating meat in order to be able to gain perspective on, and worked in farming in order to educate myself and others about the possibilities that we have for including herbivores like cows in a more responsible way into our agriculture.
And Alicia, for you, as you're thinking about this balance between individual decisions and a collective action or action on the part of these big producers, how are you thinking through that tension?
Well, you know, individual action isn't the only thing, but sometimes it's one part of a bigger plan. You know, in the United States, the industrial meat and dairy industries are subsidized by governments to the $38 billion, you know, a year. The price there isn't natural. The working conditions for people working in meat processing plants are abysmal. We saw, you know, not just about beef, but Tyson managers betting on how many workers would get COVID-19. You know, there has to be huge intervention into this industry, but there is a lot of money there. There is a lot of lobbyist money there on behalf of the industry. And so individuals saying, I'm not going to support this, is one way in which we have control against a huge machine that is causing a lot of destruction.
Well, we're hearing from lots of you today. Alicia writes on Facebook, as a vegetarian trying very hard to transition to veganism, I appreciate Epicurious's decision, but I understand that many omnivores will not. What we choose to eat is a very personal decision, and I never impose my choice on others. And Ralph writes on Facebook, I totally disagree with Epicurious. Their arguments about the environmental impacts of beef are a false narrative that doesn't take into account the many climate benefits of properly raised beef. James, before we let you go, how much does this matter, Epicurious's decision? Do you think this is going to lead other food media outlets to follow their lead?
It's a good question. You know, obviously Epicurious is a private business. They can do whatever they want, and they can, you know, it's a stunt and it's performative, but sometimes that's okay. I don't expect others will follow, but I do think that this is going to become a major clash point over the next decade. And even this week, you saw a big famous restaurant in New York announce that it's only going to serve vegetarian options when it reopens after the pandemic. So I think that this is something that is going to come up more and more, but it's hard in the short term, at least considering the blowback to Epicurious, to see others following suit.
That's James Homan. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. James, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And still with us are Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. And Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer. Her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joshua Specht is the author of Red Meat Republic, A Hoof-to-Table History of How Beef Changed America. Josh, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's nice to be back.
So how did beef become so important to the American identity and diet?
Yeah, it's an important question. And I very much enjoyed listening to this discussion because I think it reflects that story. And basically, in the decades right around 1900, beef got kind of woven into the country's DNA. And that's for, you know, a couple reasons. I mean, that's the time when what we think of as industrial beef really emerges, right? Cheap, abundant, fresh red meat, produced in highly centralized, big, essentially factories. But what's happening then is that beef is becoming really important to key populations in the United States. So first, immigrants, people coming to the United States from places like Europe who might have only had beef on special occasions, on feast days or religious holidays. Now they can have beef all the time. And you get instances of people saying to their, you know, friends or family in the old country, well, you know, life is tough, but I have red meat every day. At the same time, around that time, the labor movement is looking around the world and saying, you know, we see workers who have to live on potatoes or rice, but the success of the American worker is measured in our ability to have beef. And so to around 1900, what emerges is the idea to be successful is to eat beef, and to some extent to also be a successful man is to eat beef. And then just lastly, at that exact moment, there's a story of U.S. expansion coming at the expense of native peoples as more rangeland is created. And that creates that story of individualism, power in the American West that also helps connect cattle raising to a kind of American story. So it all takes place around 1900, and we've been wrestling with the impact of that ever since.
Meredith, I think it's important to acknowledge that when we say American identity, too often that's a shorthand for whiteness. But explain a bit more about how what beef has historically meant to other groups, like indigenous people, black people.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit tricky for me as a white woman to really explain this, but I can certainly share what I've learned from indigenous women specifically and black women specifically in my own journey in butchery and slaughter, because meat has been a really, you know, really important thing culturally for a lot of people. And so I think to just automatically, you know, I really appreciate the book Red Meat Republic, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that there is, as you say, sort of a whiteness to the way that we have relationship with meat these days. But I think we also need to acknowledge at the same time that the expansion of that sort of mindset about how we come by our food and what makes a good meal is also something that we learned, you know, from our colonial settler expansion. And we also have to remember that what came with that is like genocide and erasure of people who knew how to do agriculture in a way that didn't do harm and knew how to incorporate animals into the diet in a way that wasn't just, you know, overly mechanized or ignorant of suffering or ignorant of the fact that death is an important life process. And so I think that, you know, what I've learned from Indigenous women and Black women specifically is that, you know, there's a religious aspect and a very deep, important cultural aspect to keeping meat eating that's mindful, and slaughter and butchery that's mindful and values the whole animal as a huge piece of our culinary culture.
Here's a comment we got from JoJo on Facebook, who says, I chose not to eat beef when I was in college in 1997. I grew up poor and only knew how to cook with ground beef. I don't find the flavor appealing now. Plus, you can find ground chicken and turkey way easier than you could back in the 90s. I live in rural Washington, and it's interesting how beef is ingrained into people's identity with images of cowboys. Well, in 1998, Oprah Winfrey won a lawsuit against Texas cattle producers after they sued her for making a comment about mad cow disease and vowing to never eat a hamburger again. And they argued that her comments were the reason cattle prices plummeted. And here's Winfrey after she won the case.
This has been a very difficult and stressful time. I feel like I've come through it a stronger person. From the beginning, we realized that we had done nothing wrong. And I thank God that it's finally over. I thank God for answered prayer. I will continue to use my voice. I believed from the beginning that this was an attempt to muzzle that voice.
Now, Josh, even though the cattle producers lost, they still posed a threat to one of the most powerful women in the country. What does that say about the influence of the beef industry in the U.S.?
Well, yeah. So I think it's really interesting. So some of the context around that is, right, American consumption of beef in particular peaks in the 1970s from a high of close to 100 pounds per capita, and it's gone down significantly since to I think somewhere in the mid 60s today, which is still a significant amount. But what that means is an industry that's incredibly powerful, an industry that directly and indirectly employs millions of people in manufacturing, both ranching and processing, and an industry that's $150 billion plus today, right? It's felt itself a bit under threat. And so I think it's had to kind of fight back. And I think one of the reasons it's fought back is that there's an uncomfortable relationship between the people who raise the cattle and the companies that process meat. And a lot of what we're troubled by, kind of collectively as a society, is how meat is processed and produced at scale. And cattle raisers are aware of that, and they're uncomfortable with it, yet they have trouble separating themselves from that system. And so you see this kind of uncomfortable process by which a very powerful industry tries to protect itself, but also has these tensions between processors and raisers, traditional raisers, and maybe more raisers who want to try something different.
And Meredith, when you think about your approach to eating and cooking and talking about food, how does that tension Josh just described play into how you approach this?
Well, it plays in a big way. I mean, I think that the ethical meat sort of exploration is towards a more holistic mindset across the supply chain. So while we do explore, you know, because if we're being realistic, no, we're not going to completely eliminate the cultural significance or the taste for meat in the eating public. So the question that ethical meat raises is, okay, how can we do that in a more mindful and conscientious way? And so while we're exploring ways to produce beef and other proteins more sustainably on the land, we do also have to recognize that our bottlenecks in the processing sector and the consolidation in the processing sector and the labor issues in that sector, as well as, you know, our issues with, you know, culinary literacy mean that we do have to also consider reducing our consumption. So I think that there's a false dichotomy that's created a lot of times with people who are pro-meat ignoring all those issues and people who are anti-meat saying that they've solved them all.
We're discussing our relationship to beef and its environmental cost with Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Also with us, Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer, and her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And Joshua Specht. He's the author of Red Meat Republic, A Hoof-to-Table History of How Beef Changed America. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation about the role and the future of beef in a changing climate with Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Also with us is Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer, and she has a book coming out on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And Joshua Specht. He's the author of Red Meat Republic, A Hoof-to-Table History of How Beef Changed America. Here's a tweet we got from Jonquilin, who says, "People who work in meat processing are treated terribly. That being said, so are farm workers. Our entire food system is flawed." Josh, the costs of producing beef are not just environmental. Poor conditions for workers in meat processing and packing plants got renewed attention during the pandemic, something that was alluded to earlier in the conversation. Break down the problem surrounding labor in the beef industry.
Sure thing. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, this kind of moment right around 1900 when, as I said, beef got kind of woven into America's DNA. Well, at that moment is exactly when big meatpacking companies headquartered in Chicago realized that the key to their profit was essentially building these complicated disassembly lines that would take an animal and would very quickly process it into a processed side or quarter of beef. It revolutionizes industrial production. In his memoirs, Henry Ford says he gets his idea for the assembly line from watching a side of beef in Chicago. But what's so brilliant about it and also troubling is it basically breaks the process of butchering into a bunch of different smaller tasks for which people can be trained quickly and pushed harder and harder. And from that moment on, cutting costs starts to organize the entire food production system. So low prices, I would say, become both the organizing principle and the justification for how things are done, right? Any criticism, meatpackers say, okay, but this is what we have to do to keep costs low. And they find their profit in kind of overworking people to a dangerous degree. So you see all sorts of very serious worker injuries in around 1900. Those start to get less severe over the 20th century, but then you get repetitive stress injuries, and now you get the kind of fragility of a system that leads to the concerns we've had with the coronavirus over the past couple of years. But all of this kind of problems flow from this idea that the highest good for the system is to keep prices low for consumers, an admirable goal, but one with serious consequences.
And when we talk about workers in meat processing, you know, who is most affected by this?
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting is that since 1900 and to today, vulnerable populations or vulnerable groups form the core of the meatpacking workforce. So if the famous book, The Jungle, by Upton Sinclair, focuses on the fate of a Lithuanian family working in Chicago slaughterhouses, people who are recent immigrants, people who don't have good access to social services, maybe aren't familiar with their rights in the United States, etc. Then you get a unionization period from about 1900 to 1950, when these workers start to assert their rights, they start to get connected to the United States in ways that assert their power. But then post-1960s or so, new companies start to move slaughtering out of cities, and that's due to things like trucking, and they move them to rural places, and they again start recruiting vulnerable populations. So today, people working in slaughterhouses, you have many refugees, many undocumented people. These are people who have trouble asserting their rights or organizing to advocate for their rights, and so their marginality becomes part of the profitability of processing meat, which is an ongoing concern even today.
Well, we received a statement from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and here's part of what they sent us. Quote, beef in the U.S. is sustainably produced, and consumers should feel good about continuing to enjoy beef. Cattle farmers and ranchers are committed to producing high-quality beef in the most sustainable way possible and have been for years. That is why the U.S. is the leader in sustainable beef production. Thanks to improved resource use since the 1960s, the beef community now produces 60% more beef with 40% fewer emissions. And according to the EPA, greenhouse gas from beef cattle only represents 2% of emissions in the U.S. If all livestock in the U.S. were eliminated and every American followed a vegan diet, greenhouse gas emissions would only be reduced by 2.6% or 0.36% globally, end quote. Now, we can't independently verify all the statistics included in this statement, but one thing the EPA did verify is that emissions in agriculture have increased 20% for livestock and 8% for crop cultivation since 1990. Alicia, what's your response to that statement?
Well, I would say that, you know, there's also not just the U.S. to worry about. You know, as countries get richer globally, they consume more meat. So we have to think not just about the U.S. and about how we're consuming meat, but how we've kind of influenced a global increase in meat consumption. And so, you know, yeah, I wouldn't listen to an industry talk about their own greenhouse gas emissions. And I also think it's important to talk about global emissions rather than just the U.S. You know, if we do not change a lot about the global food system, we're not going to meet goals of the Paris Agreement to limit global warming.
Now, Josh, the statement claims that improved resource use since the 1960s has led to greater beef production with fewer emissions. What changes are they referring to?
Well, I mean, I think it would be things like pasturing practices, feeding practices, even biological changes in the animals and age at slaughter have made things much more efficient. I mean, on Alicia's point, this is why we do have to think about this as a global problem. But as far as the U.S., I mean, I think they are getting at something very important here, which is that there's a tension between producers, raisers of cattle, and processors. And I think, you know, my experience of talking to many cattle raisers is they understand there are these problems, and to some extent debates can force it to be one or the other. And I think the key is that these industries need to articulate an alternate vision of how to do this and keep kind of pushing on what they're saying they've done. And it's up to the rest of us to push them to make it more than just a statement or a kind of greenwashing. And so I think both of those things together can address a lot of this.
We got a couple of messages we got on Twitter. One of you tweeted, I think we need to keep in mind that we can't just replace pasture with crops. The reason we use that land as pasture is because it's usually not suitable for row cropping. And Usman writes on Twitter, can you get your panelists to explain what happens to the cattle and other livestock population if we stop eating them, especially those who claim that the methane emissions is a factor in their decisions? Now, Meredith, you're an advocate for sustainable meat, so I'm hoping you can answer some of the questions here.
I tend to shy away from the question of what would happen if we stopped eating domesticated animals, because I think it's sort of this like very, you know, meta hypothetical question that's not going to happen. I think it's important also to remember, to Alicia's point, that livestock keepers globally are majority indigenous people of color around the world, peasant farmers. They're not necessarily the, you know, cattlemen and industrial, you know, complex participants in the United States. And so I think that, you know, when we're talking about American meat consumption, we have to keep that in mind. And to the point that the commenter made about land use, yes, livestock are more suited to marginal lands, like, you know, very hilly territories or very rocky territories. And also to the point James made earlier, if land is taken out of pasture, I mean, pasture is one of the most stable forms to keep land in because you're not tilling it up and disturbing microbial communities and releasing carbon into the atmosphere. So we do have to think about, you know, animals are one aspect of that, but like the land-based is another aspect of that. If we take it out of animal production and pasture, what are the alternatives? Are they development? Are they tillage? Are they highly subsidized monocultures of commodity crops? And what does that do to the climate question?
We're talking to Meredith Lee. She's the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Also with us, Alicia Kennedy, a food writer. Her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And Joshua Specht. He's the author of Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history on how beef changed America. Let's turn to this last voicemail from Matthew in Florida.
As a lifelong beef eater, it's going to be hard for me personally to be able to lower down my intake for the sake of the planet. Hopefully something like Beyond Meat or Impossible Meat will get to the standard that we needed to so that it would be good enough for me to eat. But I really want to try to do my part. It's just going to be difficult.
We also got this tweet from Leanna who says, as someone suffering from irritable bowel syndrome, eating legumes causes problems. In my opinion, we have a long way to go in coming up with alternatives to meat that are easy, good, and don't cause digestive problems. Cultured meat needs to be a part of it. Now, Alicia, neither you nor Meredith are fans of beef alternatives like the Impossible Burger or cellular lab meat. Why not?
Well, cellular lab meat, one, I think we're very, very far from ever seeing it make it to the market. Two, it has, as it is now, has higher energy use than even chicken production from one study. And so, you know, cultured meat, I think, needs to not be part of the conversation because we don't know when we're going to see it. It's starting to come out in Asia, in Singapore, but we're a long way from it in the U.S. And so Impossible Burgers, you know, they rely on genetically modified soy, which it requires monocrops of soy, which is not good for biodiversity. And what we want is a diverse land use, diverse eating, so that we, you know, are doing better for the planet and doing better for diet-related disease. And, you know, Beyond uses pea protein, which, again, you know, if we start relying on this instead of beef, we're just going to have a new monocrop system that is not getting us to our land use goals.
Meredith, what about for you?
I think I echo a lot of what Alicia is saying. You know, we need to figure out a way to use our land that's holistic and diverse and sustainable. And that includes, you know, making space for really mature, diverse ecosystems and monocultures of soy and pea and whatever other plant we come up with for making, you know, fake meat out of, so to speak, is not going to get us in that direction. And I think we also have a huge problem with people eating food that is just so heavily processed that we're totally removed from the source, which is the earth that is the true producer and sunlight of all of our food. And so we need to be thinking about eating foods with the sun in it. How can we actually develop agricultural systems that are putting vital nutrients into our bodies so that we're eating from the earth and not from a lab?
Alicia, what does ethical eating look like to you when you try to define it broadly?
For me, it's about eating locally, which, you know, we could talk for another hour about the issues there, but it's about supporting a local economy. It's about supporting your personal health and nutritional needs. And it's about taking into account the ways in which industrial agriculture has kind of forced a diet on us in the U.S. in a way that doesn't support all those things that Meredith just mentioned, you know, these really mature and diverse ecosystems that we need to see. And so it's about eating, you know, within your means in the best way possible for you.
And Meredith, what about for you, especially when we think about how this conversation intersects with other conversations about just the access people have to food?
Yes, that's so important. I think I support people eating in whatever way nourishes them. And I think that that's not always going to be the most climate smart solution, because I think we do have to remember that some people aren't safe enough to prioritize ethical eating. So it's just really important to name the fact that we are, you know, contributors to the problem, but we're also victims of the problem. So I think, you know, my books and my work try to pinpoint the many different diverse entry points towards more mindful eating. And it's going to be different for different people. Some people, it might be eating more locally and regionally. Some people, it might be getting more into community and sharing the risk and the labor of a better way of eating. And for some people, it might be just getting really political and trying to get into some of those labor issues or corporate, you know, issues that Josh named earlier. So I think that there can be many different entry points towards attacking this problem. But in terms of food choices, you have to be very gentle and forgiving with yourself of where you are and what your level of safety and access is, and not be shooting or shaming yourself, because we have a very, very complex issue in front of us, indeed.
Well, and Josh, Meredith mentioned politics, and we've got to talk about the politicization of this conversation. And where does that stand as of right now in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, I think there's been an interesting development. So, you know, I told you, I was talking earlier about how this idea that, you know, for so many people around 1900 to be successful was to eat beef, as well as for many to be a successful man was to eat beef. And that kind of applied across a wide range of people. What we're seeing today is, you know, meat eating, people who identify totally as vegetarian or vegan are a quite small percentage of the population. People from both parties obviously are omnivores, eat plenty of meat. There's an attempt to kind of politicize meat eating that's been happening recently, such as associating the Green New Deal with the idea that, you know, liberals are coming for your hamburgers. That line has been reused recently. And even when I was on the show a few years ago. And, you know, I think that's a problem for a few reasons. One is this is a complex issue. And so once it gets forced into this binary where no one can concede anything, that becomes counterproductive. But I would just make one quick point, which is just that what often happens is when people question how we produce our beef, a question of production gets turned around as a threat to consumption, right? So when we raise questions about how beef is produced, people say, well, now they're coming for your hamburgers. That playbook originated around 1900. The Chicago meatpackers, people like Philip Danforth Armour, went to the U.S. Senate and said the exact same thing. So people have been doing it for 100 years. And I think we need to be aware of that play, and we basically need to hold companies, industry, and people to account for that.
That's Joshua Specht. He's the author of Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America. Also with us, Alicia Kennedy. She's a food writer, and her forthcoming book is on ethical eating and the history of the vegan movement. And Meredith Lee, the author of The Ethical Meat Handbook, Complete Home Butchery, Charcuterie, and Cooking for the Conscious Omnivore. Meredith, Alicia, Joshua, thanks for speaking with us. If you want to get a sense for what happens behind the scenes at 1A, follow us on Instagram. We're at The 1A Show. And thanks for all of your questions and comments this hour. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.